Alo.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, John. How are you doing?
I am well. How are you?
I'm fine.
Are you on a
I think this is a bit of
computer?
a lag.
Yeah, hold on a second. It'll
Sorry, what
go
was
in a
that?
second. Nothing, hold on. It'll go
Okay.
in a second. Hello.
Hello.
Are you doing?
I just finished some lunch.
What'd you
Just
have for lunch?
I had some leftover chicken curry and a slice of toast with jam afterwards. That's like a weird
Wait.
dessert, but it was leftover from breakfast and I didn't want to waste it and it's delicious, so I just ate it.
What'd you have for dessert?
A slice of toast with strawberry jam on it.
Oh, strawberry jam. Okay, I heard something completely different.
Oh, weird. What did you hear?
I heard you say that you had spiced jam, and I had no idea what that was.
Well, with this accent, assumptions are made. That's fine.
No, I think even I, whatever people say, I always hear something completely different, and it has nothing to do with accent.
Okay.
Yeah, it has
How are
nothing to
you
do with the
doing?
accent. I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right. Yeah, I'm okay. How's
How's
your ill?
your
And
husband doing?
he's much better. He is at
I
his friend's
oh, to
house
watch
watching the game.
the football game. I guess there's two distinct possible Scots that will come home.
Oh, God. Well, I'm making carnitas for dinner, so whatever happens, I feel like that should make him happier.
Wait, you're making what?
Carnitas?
Oh, wow, that's cool.
Well, slow cooker stuff.
What
Straightforward.
did you already start making it or you're gonna make it?
Yeah, no, I've already started. It's been in the slow cooker for like 2 hours, so another four, and it'll be ready.
What carnitas recipe are you using?
Oh, I just one that I found on Bon Appetit. Which reminds me, I have to get that book back.
Oh, you don't have to give me the book back. What's in the recipe? What's in the slow cooker?
Oh, literally just the pork and salt and pepper and onions and dried oregano. That's
Okay,
it.
cool.
Yeah, pretty simple.
What kind of pork is it?
It's just pork stew meat. I feel like I probably should have got like butt, but I didn't. So whatever, it's for stewing, which I assume is like slow cooking. So I think it'll work.
It's pork, man. How's it not gonna work?
I appreciate your positivity.
You appreciate what?
Your positivity.
Hell yeah, man. So how many times have you been interviewed in your life?
Maybe twice.
Was the first one?
I don't remember what the first one is, but the last time I got interviewed,
Wait, if you've only been interviewed twice, how the fuck can you not remember the first one?
yeah, I don't know, but I feel like I okay, so the last time I
Why
got
are you
interviewed was
glossing over the first time? That's the better question.
when I let me get to it. I'll get to it. I'll
Oh,
explain. The last time I was actually interviewed, it felt like a really proper interview, in that it was related to a solo show I had at this gallery in Oakland. And they just approached me completely out of the blue. This like online radio station that put out the art and culture related shows. So it wasn't like a live interview, thank God. But, you know, I felt like I had to do a little bit of preparation for it. And I felt like my answers really had to kind of make sense and sound good in some way. And I was very nervous, you know, because this is someone I don't know. Like, it's different than this interview because I know you. I'm so comfortable. And, you know, I don't know what you're going to do with this material, but, like, I don't think it's going to be, like, printed in a magazine or anything. So it doesn't feel like the same kind of thing. Anyway, the reason I'm saying I don't remember the first time or what other times I've been interviewed, probably I don't remember them because they've probably been more like this kind of interview, which feels more comfortable, which feels like, it's not with someone I don't know. It's, you know,
so you only remember the thing that was uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing that was related to like a solo show that felt like, it just felt like a little more like, oh God, I have to do really well on this, you know? So that's the difference. Whereas with this one, I'm kind of like, it really isn't the point. So it just makes me feel a little more relaxed. Oh, sorry, you broke up. What was that?
You're saying that there's no point to this?
Well, I'm saying the stakes are different. I perceive them to be different.
But when was the solo show?
It was back in 2012. It was like just before I started my PhD program. It was at this gallery in Oakland, Johansson Project. And, you know, this is like my first big solo show in like a, you know, like proper gallery, a gallery that's like well-respected and so on. So, and I think it's, you know, I was very pleased with the show and got lots of feedback on it. So,
how are you as a person at that time?
I felt really good and really confident at that point in time because I had been away from the state for 6 months or so. So I had finished my MFA and I had completed a year on a visa extension. And then my visa had run out. I couldn't find a job to get me a visa. So I had, you know, gone through some time thinking about what I wanted to do. What was my next kind of like career and life move or choice or whatever. And I had spoken to quite a number of my friends and people at my school and so on. And I'd come to the conclusion that pursuing a PhD would actually be really smart because my work was research-based and it would open many more doors for me in terms of employment. And I would also be able to, you know, if I got accepted, come back to the Bay Area, maintain my friendships and my art connections and all of that stuff. So, and at the time of the show, I felt like I had already gotten my acceptance letter. So I was feeling good that I had a solo show. I was feeling good that I'd got into the PhD program and I was coming back. And my personal life wasn't quite in the same spot. I'd just been broken up with and things were a little kind of tumultuous that way. But with everything else, I felt really good.
So during your solo show, you didn't turn into like a complete monster or an asshole, yeah?
No. Can you imagine me doing that? No.
You never know how people are, like either under pressure or, do you know what I mean?
That's true. That's true. There were, I don't think I tend to usually lash out at people, although it depends. It depends. Because I feel like there are times I'm off on that. But for the most part, I think with that show, the only time I can remember feeling really stressed, I didn't turn into a monster. I felt just deeply insecure. And I remember there were a few mornings where I woke up and I really doubted whether I could get all the work done in time. And I doubted that the work was going to be of sufficient quality. And there were one or two mornings where I remember getting up at 6 or something and just kind of like drinking chamomile tea, trying to calm down and talking to my mum, because I always talk to my mum when I'm feeling really distressed or really freaked out by something. And, you know, she was the real support and just said, like, you're going to be fine, just get through it and you can do it. And, you know, all the things that you kind of need to hear when you're feeling really insecure. So, but apart from that, the rest of the show, I mean, I feel like it all came together. The biggest emotional association I have with that show is just doubt, just a lot of doubt, a lot of self-doubt. But I feel like that's probably the case for like most artists when they're pulling together a final project or piece. I'm sure that you have felt this way when you're kind of, you know, opening night of one of your plays. There's like a bunch of stuff that's on your mind that you kind of second guess yourself about. You're like, oh God, should I have done that different? Or I wish I had more time. I would change this and this. And there's always that second guessing, I feel like. And I'm sure if I get another solo show in the future, I will most likely have the same type of initial like crushing doubt followed by fuck it, let me just get on with it and do it and it will be what it is. And then as I'm putting it up and putting it together, I'm like, fuck, why didn't I do this instead of that and blah, blah, blah. I feel like that's probably going to be the process.
So,
I mean,
what's that?
I was asking whether you had experienced something like that before. Like when you
play. Oh, yeah. No, definitely. I mean, I just get basically sick the whole time something goes on. I just feel like nausea most of the time. Yeah. That's cool, though, like that when you're insecure, you don't turn into like, you know, because I think some people can try to compensate for that by just being like really weird and shit. By like overcompensating or something. But that's good to know. That'd be cool if you are completely lying and you're just like a complete dirt bag when you're doing shit. I mean, I'm
an introvert.
I'm too self-critical.
And I think that if I'm being self-critical, then the easiest way I deal with stress is by blaming myself for something, because I feel like I can control it then. If it's my fault, then it's in the future, if I encounter this feeling again, it's, you know, like, oh, maybe I can do something about it. It's a way of dealing with stress that I don't know. I guess some people kind of like push it away and do compensatory behavior that just kind of like projects out to get away from that. But I kind of move in the opposite direction, I feel like.
And your stuff just falls into a pattern. So like the next time it happens to you, it's not like you can control how you feel. Yeah,
I mean, with anything, and again, I'm sure that you felt this too, with anything that you really give a shit about that's coming from you, and you feel like you really want to make sure that you're doing a good job on it, which quite frankly is like any project. I feel like, what was the question again? Sorry, my brain just totally blanked.
So I think one thing that I was interested in knowing is like, so when you did the solo show, like, because I don't know about this shit, it's like, can people buy stuff or is it Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it depends on the gallery.
Right.
I mean,
like
honestly,
for your show, they're like stuff was for sale, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I had drawings, a video. I'm like, everything was for sale.
So I guess the one question I have for you is, how do you assign value to the stuff that you make?
You asking me how I price my pieces?
Well, you could call it, if you want to call it that, or just like in general, do you know what I mean?
Okay,
Because I would think whatever answer you have for how you price your pieces is some weird fucking strange math that you came up with in your head. But I think, because to me, like, I think what's interesting to me is, I know it's like part of how you do it is like your hands are all over everything. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like there's like the fucking, it being like almost handmade, right?
Right.
And like, that's part of the aesthetic, right?
Yeah.
I know that part of it gets to like, to your relationship with technology and shit, or like your ideas of it, you know? But I guess
yeah,
I'm probably going about this like sideways or whatever, but like, how do you view the value of your work? Like, do you assign like a, this is worth money, or how do you know what I mean? How do you think of your work, or you don't give a shit?
Yeah. Well, when I'm making the work, I don't really think about that at all. And I frankly don't really think about value in any kind of monetary sense unless I'm showing it to the gallerist and saying, what numbers do I write here in the catalogue next to each thing? I don't really, yeah, it's just not something I think about at all when I'm starting on a project. I mean, the value that I think about when I'm starting a project is much more, is much more like about the questions I want people to ask, or the narratives that perhaps I feel like need interrupting, or it's actually interesting because I was having a conversation with a curator friend yesterday or the day before yesterday, what were we talking about? Oh shit, I can't remember. But my brain just happens. This is why I hate interviews, because this happens quite a lot. My brain blanks. But it was something related to, oh, that's right. It was about kind of, you know, why do artists make work? And, you know, there are different types of artists. And she and I are both of the mind that there is a social obligation tied to being an artist that involves questioning the culture that you're in. The work that you produce should ask viewers or participants or visitors to the whatever space you're in to ask specific questions or to challenge them in some way, right? So it's a much more kind of active cultural experience rather than kind of like passive, like I don't know, like whatever. Like I don't know, watching your favorite TV show that's just like a piece of candy, you know, it's not engaging you in any intellectual way or challenging you in any like social way. In that sense, the value that I'm trying to create through my work, or certainly that I think about a lot, and especially since being in the PhD program, has to do with that, has to do with what contribution am I making to the culture and the society that I'm in, and how do I want to kind of like challenge or get people to think about, how they live and how that's informed by certain histories and certain histories that are seen and histories that are unseen, and things that objects saw people or practices that they kind of like take for granted. And I see it as my job to try and kind of make people think about those things. And, you know, working with the aesthetics that I work with, which are distinctly like lo-fi and very handmade and, you know, visually kind of, I personally struggle with the word amateur because they don't look, I mean, they look handmade, but they don't look crappy. Like I like to think that like I'm pretty good at, you know, drawing and painting. So, that has come from like years and years and years of practicing it.
Definitely. So a question I have then is why do you insert yourself? And this isn't like, I don't think of this as like a negative question, but like, what is the purpose of the audience being aware of you in the creation of it?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question because when I started making video work, I was using puppets. I don't think you've ever seen this like really early stuff that I made, but
no,
when I graduated, they were all animal puppets. I finished my undergraduate degree by doing a lot of drawings, ink drawings of like animals enacting pretty violent situations or kind of like weird, uncanny situations that, you know, if you switched out the animal for a human, then it would be a really problematic image. But, you know, and then that also encompasses like animal symbolism and so on and so forth. So when I first started like moving into videos, I was making puppets, animal puppets, and kind of enacting some of those scenes. But I would be the puppeteer, and like eventually I got to a place where I was making full costumes, and I was just for ease to kind of just get the work done, I was the actual person in the video, or I did this one series of cat, I made this cat costume, and I was the cat. And I know, I really should show you some of these pictures. They're pretty weird. But hey, they got me interviews at pretty, really, pretty good schools. Anyway, I stopped doing that because I didn't want people to kind of ask me about like, why are you putting yourself there? Or, you know, what are the artists as the model? And what about that? And it was a question that wasn't that interesting to me. But now that you're saying, I'm kind of still doing it. You just can't see my physical body, but you can certainly see my handicraft. It's because I don't make videos that are like seamless worlds that look exactly like the world that we know. Like that's absolutely not what I want to create.
So is that a function of because you don't have the money for it? And if you had the money for it, you would, or absolutely not? It's like, that's the point.
Well, initially, again, in that experimental phase, it was about money. But it was, but I think slowly I kind of came to realize that this was an aesthetic that had more meaning for me and that I purposefully didn't want to create anything that looked particularly beautiful or really well done or
So shiny. What is the aesthetic then that is important to you?
Handmade, and I will say the word amateur, and I will say
I mean, you can say any fucking word you want.
Thanks. I would say I don't know. In a way, I kind of want to say like that. I want it to look like anybody could make it. You know, like
why
that anyone
you,
could make.
Why
it.
Do you want that? Or what? What then? What then are you urging then?
Well, it's definitely a question of authorship. And it's funny because, I don't know, I think I have like a control. I think I have a personality that really needs to be in control of my own shit. Because I could very easily collaborate with a lot of people to make my sets for me. I mean, on that side of things, maybe it's partly financial, but it's actually not at all. I think it's more to do with, I want to be the one who has made all of this. This is my work. And I'm starting to think about the idea of, I don't know, kind of suggesting like, well, anyone can do this. And actually people do. I mean, you go on YouTube and you can see that people are making pretty amazing, weird, elaborate things. But I have a couple of projects that I've worked on that aren't videos, that are book projects, that are that invite readers to participate in the bigger project, to kind of create their own versions of what I'm, you know, making in the book or whatever. So
cool.
I think it is about. Go ahead.
No, please go. No, please go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think the question of authorship is really important. And that could also be something to do with like my own political views and like being a feminist and believing that, you know, for anything to have a kind of distinct meaning for anyone or particular group, it should not necessarily conform to what the standard is, or any conceptions of like what aesthetics, what are good aesthetics or bad aesthetics, or you know, something along those lines. I think it's definitely about challenging expectations in some way. I'm not saying that I'm making anything original. There are like there are a few people who are working in this kind of handmade aesthetic way of producing videos, but there is a certain like level of crappiness that I really am attracted to in the aesthetics. Like I really despise kind of like perfection. If I wanted to be making that kind of work, then I'd either spend a lot of time applying for money, or I would be working in an industry where I would have access to those groups of people, or you know, that, I don't know, that expertise or whatever. But I have absolutely no desire to follow that route. And it's also about like just getting shit done. I'm the worst self-promoter. I don't apply to a lot of things. I'm trying to be better about that. But really the biggest thing I give a shit about is making stuff. And so if you're spending half your time applying for grants or waiting to hear for, can I use this station or whatever, I get very frustrated by that. Because I just kind of want to get on with making the bloody thing. And, you know, like so many people in my program, PhD people, are filmmakers, and filmmakers just have to wait for the money. And I don't have the patience for that. I just don't care about everything looking perfect.
So what are you working on right now, other than your dissertation?
Other than my dissertation, okay. You know that I'm doing like a visual dissertation, right?
Oh, I'm sorry, say it one more time.
Are you on a bus?
No, no, no.
Are you in the grocery store?
Yeah, I'm in the grocery store.
All right.
What item do you think I'm doing right now?
What's that?
I'm checking out right now.
Place your item.
So what are you working on right now?
I am working on my vision project for my dissertation. I'm like filming that stuff now. But I'm also working on
the bagging area.
I'm working on this book, this like Thaumatrope book, which is a history of women computers. I'm trying to finish up that. I'm working on. Oh, I'm trying to plan a project.
Wait, say it again.
Oh, I'm trying to plan my next project, which is based on this really weird machine. It's like a speaking machine that was built in the 1840s, but it very weirdly, it looks like a big table, which is like half table, half piano. But the front of it.
Hold on.
Hold on a second, Tina. Hold on a second.
Yeah, I can get the scan.
Sure. Hold on. Yeah. Thank you, Dan. This is the intermission part right now.
Right.
Remember to take your receipt.
I don't know why I think I could do more than one thing at a time. I literally can't.
It's fine.
All right, we're done.
Okay.
So let's go back. Because there's a thread that we're headed down, and then so I know what you're mentioning about fucking your early drawings and shit, using mm-hmm. animals with like violent shit. What is your relationship with violence?
You know, other people have asked me this, and I had a friend come to my studio and she actually interviewed me and she asked me the same thing. And I don't think I have a very good answer for that because I'm not entirely sure.
Uh-huh.
Because it features quite a lot in my work, especially my drawings.
Do you experience like psychotic imagery in your mind a lot?
No, not at all.
That'd be great if you're totally lying and like your hands are clenched and you're like bleeding through your hands because you're so angry.
Sorry to disappoint you, John, but no.
No.
I actually, I think it has more to do with, I don't know, with kind of some kind of symbolism. I think for me, oftentimes,
does that have to do with, like,
when I'm
male impotence,
in some of my projects, yes, because a lot of drawings I know in my undergrad, and there are some drawings that I've made since then. It's a lot of sexual violence, and I think that it's more to do with drama and symbolism than it actually has to do with actual violence.
Uh-huh.
So that's what I think my relationship is. So it's kind of a distance, kind of a disconnected relationship to it, which, you know, is, I don't really know how I feel about that because it's a I think that's problematic. At the same time,
let me ask you this question.
Yeah.
Why do you think you're saying that the use of sexual violence it's for drama, right? Or it's to like connotes drama?
Yeah.
What drama does it connote for you then? is it like the shattering of illusions or like the end of things, or do you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. That's a really good question.
Because I wonder about if you say that, like, right, it's one thing if you're like, no, dude, like, I deal with a lot of psychotic imagery in my mind, and this is a way that I use to, like, whatever, right?
Yeah.
But it's interesting to me, like, the world that you set your work in,
mm-hmm.
namely, like, that seemed like a real shitty place. And not, you know, it's not that love and kindness wasn't... I always assume, like, within the myths of, like, the... When I think of the 19th century, I think of that as, like, mostly, like, in the parts of North America that were, like, being colonized by white people, that, like, it's just, like, violence and bad shit.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me, like, on your website, like, the fucking picture for, like, your header...
Yeah.
It's the dude with the axe.
Mm-hmm.
And I know in my head it's like pointed towards like a piece of technology. Or that's how I interpret it. Like he's like about to fucking he's like, I'm sick of this or whatever, like if it's a whatever the fucking technology is, right?
Yeah.
But then there's the woman. And I always think that she's next.
Yeah, it's okay. So here's a couple of things. Just as you're talking, it's making a couple of things click in my mind. That I will say that when I do draw very violent things, I often use imagery, for example, like the animals, or very romantic. My drawing style is very kind of romantic. And it's always, since I was a kid, I have been fascinated with drawing like myths. And you know, like classical or historical imagery. And so in a way, there's always like some kind of butting up against or testing the limits of, or I don't know, like juxtapositioning, something very romantic and kind of beautiful with something that is deeply disturbing, which of course sexual violence is. And I think that that kind of disconnect between like the aesthetics and the content is something that I have that really fascinates me, and I think is definitely an engine, like slotting those two things together. So that's one thing.
Who are usually the perpetrators of the sexual violence in your work?
Men.
It's always men. It doesn't like cut through. It's usually dudes.
Thinking back, like yeah. Usually.
Yeah.
There was another part to that question which I can't remember. Sorry, another blank moment for me.
Oh.
But I can't remember. What were you What were you talking about a little while ago when you were elaborating on your question?
Just like the idea of, right, and you said things, right, so there's like the myth of the frontier,
oh,
and you
right,
setting
yeah.
you setting work in that world to like... Yeah, there's something strange about, like, yeah. Yeah, there's, yeah, it's weird because I kind of ascribe, like, the sound of, like, old-timey piano or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, there's something very fucking weird about your shit with dudes. And sex violence, and it's really funny to me.
Okay, well, that's good. I'm glad that there's some humor there, because humor is important.
Oh, so, I mean, I find most depictions of sexual violence funny because, like, yeah, they just, it's not going to work out for the dude.
Well, okay, so I would say that I'm wondering whether there's a question there in your bringing up, you know, especially in my dissertation, you know, the myth of the frontier and, you know, the how I would extend that would be that I have a general fascination with history, with kind of far history. I don't just mean like 50 years ago history. I mean like long ago history. And even where that history kind of like borders with myth, I think it's one of the reasons I was so interested in doing the dissertation that I'm doing. And like how history becomes myth and how myth becomes history and like how those narratives are very complexly involved in like acts of translation, some kind of like translation. And the language that's used to make something, let's say, history instead of myth. So I think one of the reasons that I have worked as I have worked by using like images of violence is to try and get away from any feeling of nostalgia, because I think it's really easy when you represent the past and kind of depict the past. And this is also a very personal thing to me too, because I think I do have a very romantic idea of, you know, images from a certain time and so on. And, you know, I was a little person, you know, I was really kind of, I was obsessed with myths, and I did romanticize them because, you know, when you have kid books about myths, they are romantic. And I think in a way, I mean, I'm wondering whether me working through some of these images is a way to, I don't know, like extract the romance or the kind of, yeah, the nostalgia from times and places that were, as you said, like not great and not like pleasant and not like these like beautiful kind of perfect places that oftentimes, you know, that's how they'll be shown.
But the funny thing to me is, right, you can go after things like that and like destroy myth or nostalgia and all that. But it's funny to me then you like seeing your hand in all of it and like the analog nature of it. That to me, yeah, is the funny thing about it. You know what I mean?
Right. Do you mean that like specifically my hand or just the fact that it looks handmade?
Both.
Yeah, I mean, again, I see that, but I mean, I guess that's the point of me using those aesthetics, because, you know, we're surrounded by representations of history that are, you know, like perfect and beautiful, and like what are statues if not kind of glorifications of some kind of idealized past symbolized in a specific person or an event or something like that. And, you know, like how much more stable, you know, quote unquote stable and, you know, quote unquote enduring can you get than something cast in bronze? So in a way, my use of like cardboard or yeah, kind of doing things kind of slipshod and not perfect is a way to kind of find a visual language to talk about history and historical narratives that don't necessarily glorify it in that way, that kind of problematize or banalize or make it more vernacular, or I don't know, just kind of make it more, I don't really want to use the word normal, but just kind of just take the gloss off of it somehow. I think that is really important.
I guess talk about a little bit, but it's like, how, as me as a viewer, can I can't truly experience the work through your website.
Right.
And that to me is funny as well.
Well, I think that means I just have to do a better job of getting shows.
But it's like the one that you have, I forget the one that's called the 27, that you watch through the viewfinder, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm actually going to be installing that somewhere at the start of March.
Is that the exploratorium thing?
Yeah, exactly. So I'm kind of, maybe I'll be able to get documentation of it that will provide more of a sense of like what it is. What you're talking about, yeah, I don't really, like, where my brain goes is, oh, shit, I'm not doing a good job of documenting my work.
I don't think of it in that sense. I don't think it was a negative. I think of it as a funny thing.
Now, I'm curious, like, when you say funny, what do you mean exactly by that? Because I feel like your use of the word funny is actually quite complicated. So I'm curious for you to explain that. Because I don't think you just mean ha-ha funny, although maybe that's a part of it. So.
Well, I think at times it's like the sex to me is like the sexual violence thing is funny because like it's like last resort stuff.
Right.
It's usually this woman has either outthought me or outspoke me and I'm upset, so all I can really do now is attack her.
Right.
And it's like obviously like the violence is like terrible and all that shit, but like what drives it is hilarious to me. You know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like
sure.
I lost.
Right. Well, ultimately, really, I mean, this is about power, right, then? Because really, that header image that you're referencing is actually one section of a larger drawing in which it's actually a kind of, it was referencing like a tradition of like illustrated newspapers that were super, super popular in the 19th century. And they illustrated crimes and tragic happenings, spectacular happenings, often very, as I said, like either violent or tragic. That image comes from a narrative that I developed about a family that buys some kind of wireless device. And the family has three teenage daughters and one very small son. And the daughters become obsessed with the machine to a degree where the family calls in a doctor to kind of see what they can do for these three girls. And it's just decided that they're completely unhelpable. And so, you know, it's up to you what you want to do with them. And so they're kind of sedated, and there are images within this larger drawing that's kind of divided into boxes, almost like a comic, but not quite like a comic. But by the end of the narrative, the girls have been kind of institutionalized in the family home. So they've been, you know, like put inside boxes or tied to chairs or kept in the basement or something like that. So it's not so much sexual violence there, but it is to do with gender and power and, you know, obviously like patriarchy and maintaining some kind of order. So there's that for sure. And I just kind of in a way wanted to contextualize what that image is, where that's coming from.
I'd love to see it. That'd be cool, man.
But yeah, I mean, I guess me telling you this is to kind of say, like, not all images that I draw are specifically sexual in nature.
I don't see that through, like, most of the stuff. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think the question I have of, like, violence, like, it's impossible to think of then or, like, depictions of, like, the fucking West without the specter of violence.
Yeah, right. Right.
So there's something weird. I have no idea what it means or whatever, but violence and then you making hand-created things. There's something very funny to me about that.
Yeah, okay.
Right,
yeah,
you're
asking
what I meant by funny, and I think, like, it's funny to me, too. Like, it's funny in a different way, the thing of, like, not being able to see your work as it actually is on the website, but that's, like, with most things. But that, to me, is also the funny thing, then, about it seems like your shit with technology as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Can you say a little bit more about that, about what you're thinking right there?
Because it seems like on a certain level you're like, fuck technology. Or, right, like the idea that just because it's new doesn't mean it's fucking great and all this shit.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. Do you want me to talk a little about that? Or?
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether it's a consequence of I don't know, first off, whether there's much more to it than that. I mean, obviously there is. That's actually quite complicated to say, like, well, you know, we need not kind of just, like, unblinkingly accept everything that, you know, branded or labeled new as, you know, something that is necessarily better than what came before or different than what came before. And maybe that is a consequence. Maybe my interest in that is a consequence of, like, living here where I live in the Bay Area. But I don't know. Like, I think that I'm still coming to terms with what it is about that I find so interesting. Because my interest in this, in kind of understanding the role of technology in making us feel like we're living in a modern age, or making us feel like up to date or you know, quote unquote developed, really developed, that kind of interest kind of came about at the very end of my MFA. When I started reading books about I just discovered all these authors who were writing about technology from the 19th century and how important they were to understanding our relationship to technology today, and how a lot of the products and a lot of the technologies that we use now really exist, have existed for like centuries, but just in different forms. And but I don't know, like, I don't think I've fully worked out yet what about that I find so deeply fascinating. And maybe again, it's as simple as like wanting to question the gloss of it, or the myth of it, the myth of like the new, or you know, equating like new things with like better things. And like, we live in a society now where I don't know, like technology and science are pretty they are the kind of overarching organizational, I don't know, like cultural kind of structures that basically just kind of make us live the way that we live. And so maybe there's something there that I'm, I really don't think I can answer that very well.
Where did your fascination then of the frontier come from then?
Well, that purely came up because of my dissertation and my specific interest in the Pony Express. That's where that came from.
Where did the time frame, or where did the finding, like the interest in that time period, where the fuck did that come from?
Okay, so I've already said that I have a very like a vested interest in like the 19th century, like late 18th up to the end of the 19th century. I think is a really, really fascinating period, mostly because it, when a lot of, you know, like Western society is changing into some kind of industrial society, which is the society that we now live in a very developed form. So in a way, I'm kind of interested by trying to understand how that happened and where that comes from. And when I first found out about the Pony Express, I just kind of came across a book somewhere in some library, I don't know. And I read it and I thought, oh, this is really fascinating. And as I was, the more I thought about the Pony Express, the more, you know, it's already within that time period that I'm interested in. What really, really interested me in the Pony Express is that it was existing at a time where like this country was really, really changing, like the society and the culture and the economics, like everything about the country was like shifting from one way of living to another. And the Pony Express was this kind of thing that existed, that kind of existed in like this, I felt like it symbolized that shift very, very appropriately, that it was like this really kind of old fashioned, not technological method of communicating. But what really made it special was something that I think is very modern, which is trying to communicate as fast as possible. So, and you know, this is like a time when, like, you know, like trains and telegraphs and all of that kind of stuff, they already existed. They existed at the same time, but there wasn't there wasn't like infrastructure for them at that time to cover the ground that was needed, that needed to be covered. And so they, you know, so like instead of using like cutting edge technology, instead of using, you know, new technology, they had to actually, the people who decided to kind of, there's a need for this like fast communication, so how can we make it happen? They had to kind of look backwards at an older form. And I think that kind of weird combination of like it being old and new at the same time, and that it kind of in operation at an absolutely crucial time in the history of the US, is really what kind of made me want to sink my teeth into it. Because I felt like there were like levels of, there was like some kind of like symbolic like connection between what it was and the time. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I'm repeating myself now, but I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. So like there, But you were never interested really in like the myths of like the British Raj in India, yeah? Or were you when you were younger?
Yeah, no. That's a really great, that's a great point. I've never been interested in that. I mean, I understand why you go there. I totally get it. But for some reason, I've never been interested in that.
Right. I guess it's an unanswerable question. Like, why do people like what they like? But it's interesting to me, one, I understand that like something caught your attention of like the 18th and 19th century, and then like the American frontier, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's interesting.
Well,
so you have
no
idea.
You have no idea if
there was like a British version of this in India?
Oh, that's a really good question. In terms of like a Pony Express, I don't think so.
Here's another question, and obviously I'm asking this because you're from there.
Hmm.
Have you found, or are you interested in any depictions of like English or like the other in the frontier?
Wait, ask that question again.
I was just wondering if you had found, or if there's any interest in like British shit in the Old West.
Oh yeah, sure. You know, like most Mormons were English, right?
No, I had no idea.
Yeah, most Mormons, a lot of Mormons who moved westward were English immigrants who had come over, and you know, when they were like, when the Mormons were like kicked out of their eastern hub, and were moving west to, you know, what would become Salt Lake City. I mean, a lot of those people were English,
but like straight up, like you English, not like English. My parents were English.
No, like actual English people who came from England to the States and
then
became Mormon.
Wow, I had no idea. Wow, that's really fucking weird.
Yeah. I mean, there are lots of, like, in my research in the West, I'm actually just going through a couple of books now that were written around about the same time as the Pony Express, and they are people who kind of made a transcontinental journey via stagecoach. And I am picking out all of the descriptions of the stations that they stopped at and the people who manned those stations. And there are, you know, most of these people are like immigrants from England or Ireland, or maybe they're French Canadian, and they have, you know, like Native American partners and children. And there are lots of English people there. There are lots of English people there, like straight up English people. Like there are lots of English immigrants who rode for the Pony Express.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. I think it, in a sense, like in the myths in my mind of the Old West, I always forget like that that's a possibility.
Right.
That's not just like all fucking Americans or like recent Americans. Huh.
Yeah. Right. But, you know, it's interesting, like, one of the things that I think draws me to time periods that are not recent, they're, like, maybe over, I would say that my general, like, interest in the history kind of is history that starts from maybe, like, 120 years back. So, and honestly, like, thinking about it now, I'm like, I think there's something there about the fact that we can look at those times and there's a part of it that seems really familiar because there are some parts of like, you know, the industrial 19th century that we understand from our point, even living in the 21st century, there's enough of a similarity in like the way people work, the work day, the kinds of machines that are being used, the production, types of production. Like we can identify with that, even though it's a long time ago, but there is also enough there that makes it strange. It's like a weird mixture of the strange and the familiar that, again, like I think I'm very interested in kind of like in between things, in between like times or things that are like old and new at the same time or, you know, like mechanical and not mechanical or, and trying to kind of like figure out where the boundary between those two things are. And in a way, I think that's also happening in my work because with the amount of labor that goes into making each of my videos, at the end of the day, they're still videos. They are digital videos. They aren't, it's not like you are going into that set and you're surrounded by cardboard trees and whatever, like you, what you are watching is an image on a screen. And one of the big interesting questions I was trying to think through during my master's program was where is the boundary, like how crappy can I make this look before it becomes kind of unacceptably like a complete little world, and like how much does the camera itself actually make that world a world, you know, like if all of this shit was in a room and you walked in, it wouldn't be the same as, you wouldn't have the same experiences, you wouldn't conceive it as a world in the same way as when you look at it on a screen. So there's like the tension between the handmade and the technological and, you know, the kind of mediation going on, like the role of the camera, the lens, all of that stuff in making you see it and perceive it in a specific way. And, you know, for a long time, I'm starting to change my mind about this now, but for a really long time, after I made a video piece, I would throw away all of the things I used as sets and props because I didn't want there to be any kind of reference left over to the world that I made, you know, in this like video. It was really important that sorry, go ahead.
You were about to say why it was important to you. Why is that?
I think because I was curious to see what it took to get beyond the power of the camera. Like, I don't know. And like, if you're not, this is what I'm kind of starting to kind of reassess my choice to kind of get rid of everything, because that already puts that camera image in it privileges the power of the camera when all you have is just that screen. So I'm starting to think like, well, maybe I want to show some of the props to kind of force more thought there, but trying to like trying to figure out like what would interrupt that power, the power of that digital image. Like, how is it to do with like how many props are there? Is it to do with how well I paint a piece of cardboard to look like a table? Is it to do with, I don't know, the fact that you can see that I've missed certain spots or how, and I think I'm still kind of dealing with that as a question. You know, the fact that I'm even thinking about reintroducing some of those props into a gallery space that I'm showing that video in is a way of kind of like maybe suggesting that the tension between the kind of handmade and the technological like needs to be maybe it within the space, within the viewer's physical space or something like that. But I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I love that question.
I think that's that to me is what's funny about it in a way of like, right, how do you make it where you're not subservient to the camera and trying to make it look good for the camera itself? Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, is this up to is it up to the same worth as like the technology of the camera?
Yeah, right.
Or like, thank you so much, Mr. or Ms. Camera, for letting me use you. I hope this is good enough for. Yeah, that I think that's a funny thing with your work then.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's almost like how can you tell the camera to go fuck itself and just use it in the same way that you would the tree as a prop.
Right. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, one of the things that I think it's about really is about trying to make the rules of the camera visible, because there are certain rules, as you said, you know, like if I'm going to make this look really good, then I have to light things in a certain way or I have to position them in a certain way, because ultimately it all comes down to how the lens is going to absorb what's in front of it, right? So kind of interrupting that in some way, trying to figure out what those rules are and then maybe not following them is one way to tell the camera to go fuck itself, you know? Like, I'm not going to give you what you want. I'm not going to produce a kind of image that is what is usually produced or what is expected to be produced or, is beautiful or something like that. And I think like a lot of really early video artists were trying to kind of answer these same questions. And the way that some of them went about it was to kind of actually just sidestep the lens altogether and like mess with the actual innards of the camera, with the kind of transmission, what was the actual electronics of it. Now, I'm less interested in that. I'm much more interested in how you can interrupt I'm much more interested in the like visual rules of the camera, the aesthetics, and like how you can fuck with that. And one of the ways I want to try and do it is by kind of placing importance or privileging handmade things and having those handmade things be the objects of the primary objects of attention, whatever that the camera is filming or recording or capturing. And I don't know, like trying to figure out like how to make them look more handmade or I don't know, having different types of handmade things interact with one another. You know, that's one of the main reasons I have like, you know, quote unquote real actors within my sets is to kind of push that, the fakeness of it, like even further. You know, there's one thing that looks this way, but then there's another thing that looks this way, which, you know, there's like a person in a costume, then there's a piece of cardboard that's like supposed to be a chair or something. So it's about like representation too, I guess. I mean, ultimately, as much as it is to do with the privilege of technology or the primacy of like technology in our lives now and how subservient we are to it, or our belief in it, or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's the other, I think that's the other way things that, when you ask me about what's funny or how I define funny, that to me is the funny thing about your work, man.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah, and it seems like an interesting challenge of how to, how to not either apologize to the camera or bow down to it, but just have it as, that's a really interesting challenge that seems like when you do it the right way, it must feel fucking funny.
Well, it feels fun for sure. Funny sometimes, but fun definitely.
So yeah, Scott told me that you got the thing at the Exploratorium. So what the fuck? How'd that come about?
I don't know. You know, I think that, because I just got this email out of the blue, which is kind of great. And I went to meet with this super sweet woman last week. And she told me that she had actually had my name on all this for a while. And I think that she had actually seen my solo show in Oakland all those years ago. And she had just kind of made a note like, this is someone I should probably just keep tabs on. And it just kind of figured out at this particular point in time, this like event that they're having, which is an event that is about the history of cinema and moving image technologies and so on. It's called Extended Cinemas. And it's basically just kind of like charting this history from, you know, pre-cinematic devices, which is where my work goes up through, you know, cinema and television, and now, you know, digital technologies and virtual reality and so on and so forth. So it actually sounds like it's going to be a pretty awesome event. It's a shame it's only a one-night thing, but all the same, I'm pretty excited to see how they, you know, end up designing the whole thing and who else they've got involved. But
when,
I'm pretty dope. I think it's on the 1st of March.
Got
the
it.
Evening of the 1st of March.
What day of the week?
And so I think, I think it's just Thursday.
Yeehaw.
Yeah.
Let me ask you one more question and then I got to go. Where do you see yourself existing in the 19th century?
Where do I?
What would have happened to you? What would have happened to you on the frontier? Do you ever have flights of fancy of what would have happened to you?
No, honestly, if I lived at that time, I would not have gone. It would have been too scary for me. Honestly, I think that knowing me, I probably would have stayed in whatever city I was living in.
Huh, that's really cool.
If I had a choice, probably I wouldn't have had a choice, but if it had been up to me, I probably wouldn't have gone there. But who knows? I don't know.
That to me is interesting then too, where it's like, it's not a thing where, you know what I mean? Like, there's not like this hunger for reenactment because you you missed out on it and you would have done this and you would have done that.
Yeah.
No, it's interesting to me. You've been like, no, fuck that, man.
Huh. Yeah, I don't think I would have done very well there. And I think I just would have been really scared. And I think I probably would have. I think I would have not wanted to go. If my dad married me off to someone and this person said, like, we're going out west, I would have thought, fuck no. I'm absolutely sure that's how I would have.
What would you have done then?
I don't, what could I have done? I couldn't have done anything. I probably would have had to have just shut up and gone. You know? I mean, what else could I have done? Like, run away from my husband? I don't think I would have done that. At least I would have had protection if I'm married. I don't know.
That's an interesting idea to me, then, that idea of, like, right, because usually I always think that it's, like, people are, like, seeking places that they want to go, or it's, like, do you know what I mean? But, like, depictions of people who fucking didn't want to be there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. All right. Thanks, dude. This is awesome. I'm going to send you some more questions.
Okay, thanks. This is really interesting. I hope it was helpful.
Hell yeah, man. Yeah. I think you get an idea of what I'm interested in, just like talking about and stuff. So yeah, I'll send you more stuff.
All right. Sounds pretty good. Please give Yael and the little one a hug for me.
I will. I hope the Vikings win.
Well, we'll see. And I guess Scott and I will be down in LA at the end of February, so it would be lovely to meet.
Yeah, remind us when you'll be here, and then hooray.
All right, sounds good.
All right, man.
All right, take care.